And the first bill up today is Senate Bill 7. And we have to speak on behalf of that bill the Senate President, Senator Adams, as well as Senator Yee. And we welcome you to the committee and be delighted to have your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair. You're up here so much now, Mr. President. I am honored to be here today with Senator Yee, who shares the concern that I share about what we need to do under Measure or Senate Bill 7. In order to address what I consider to be a fairness, what better day than days right around tax time to talk about fairness? Tax system has to be fair if you're going to expect people to follow it and have confidence in it. Frankly, right now, Oregon has an unfair situation. We have a situation where if you are a retired individual and you are receiving PERS benefits for a specific period of time, or you're a federal retiree and you're receiving benefits for a specific period of time, you have the equivalent of a tax-free from the state income. However, though, if you are a private retiree with exactly the same type of income, exactly the same type of income, you must pay taxes on that income. That's just simply not fair. That needs to be changed. It needs to be fixed. That's one of the things that Senate Bill 7 does, is it fixes that and makes that fair. There is another piece to Senate Bill 7 that addresses fairness between government entities. And that is that the way, and it's very complicated, and it is very complicated how we've gotten ourselves to this particular point, situation, is that in the way that we have resolved it, we have, in effect, on the state level, shifted costs to local governments unfairly. Senate Bill 7 will fix that. It will fix it by going back to what the original promise was. The original promise that we made as a state, whether I agree or disagree, but it was a promise, we would not tax a certain portion of state PERS retirees' income. We needed to simply honor that. Go back to the base premise, quit the scheming, quit all of the other fancy footwork that we've tried to do, and just do that. Do not tax those people because that's what we promised them to do. Should the court say then we should not tax federal retirees? We need to honor that and not tax them. And then out of fairness, not tax the private retirees. If we do that, we will then have a system that treats all of those same class of people fairly and also then does not shift the cost to city and county government. Now, it will cost us some money in order to do that. In Senate Bill 7, we are proposing that that we quit taxing private retirees occur in the 2001-03 period. And we've had staff take a look at what that would be, the impact that would have to the state. The impact in the 2001-03 period to the state would be $93 million, approximately $93 million. I then took a look at the 2001-03 period and had a forecast made of how much money we will have available to spend at that point in time and how much we can expect reasonably to spend. The conclusion on that is at this point in time, based on the best forecast that information that we have available, we will have $92 million surplus in the 2001-03 period. That is the amount of money that can fund non-taxation of private retirees. The plan, though, does create a challenge in the 99-01 period, because by going back to the original promise of not taxing PERS retirees, and the state then losing that revenue and having to pick up the cost for that promise, which is the state who has made that promise, it would have a $22,400,000 impact in the 99-01 period. I would suggest again that if we're going to spend money, the first thing you spend is money that is making sure that we're treating people fairly. In this case, people in this case are the cities and counties. We need to treat them fairly and not shift our cost responsibility over to them. And I believe in this budget, as we go through the negotiations on the budget, that we would be able to find the $22 million plus that's necessary in order to do that. So today is, for me, a day that it's not just good public policy. It's a day when the state should do the right thing. And Senate Bill 7 allows us to do the right thing. And I would hope that the committee would consider that. Senator Yeen may have a few words that she would like to make.
Well, for the record, I'm Senator Mayhew representing Senate District 19. And I want to say it's a real honor for me to co-sponsor this bill with Senate President Adams. At the beginning of the session, I went to see Senate President Adams to say that I have a lot of constituents who are concerned that there is lack of equity between public pensioners and the private pensioners. Why should one, the private sector, pay taxes on their pensions when public employees are exempt? And I also have constituents who are saying that the local government and school employers who have to pay increase in benefits to make up for the increase in taxes. And this is taking away their very scarce resources to pay for these increases out of the program money they have. When I expressed this concern to Senate President, he said that he has a bill to address these concerns, and he's kind enough to let me co-sponsor this bill. I think this is a great bill. It'll make a lot of pensioners very happy and make the local government happy too. I have a constituent who represents Albany City Human Resources Department, and he said that he is here to say a few words of support. So when you call for a witness, you'll be happy.
Thank you. Are there questions? Mr. President, let me ask you on the impact of this. You characterized in the out years of 01-03 is about 91 million.
93 million.
Well, I think, okay. And you said there is a projected surplus of a like amount. As you know, some people don't view a surplus as a surplus, view it as some critically needed expenditure for something else. And again, your position is the first thing we should do is try to incorporate fairness into the tax code.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. That would be a very good description. That if we have the ability, or not, it shouldn't even be based on whether we have the ability. If the government can't be fair, what can it be? I believe this is fundamentally a fairness issue. That if you've got people that, the example that comes to mind, I used to be a teamster, and if I had stayed as a teamster, I'd be getting close to my retirement age at this particular point in time. And if I was a teamster in the private enterprise system getting a pension income, I would have to pay all of the Oregon taxes associated with that, regardless of when I earned that income. If, though, I was a member or had worked for state government as a truck driver, if I had earned some of that income prior to 1991, I wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. That's just simply not fair. And that's what this bill tries to address. It tries to address that fairness. And I believe that we have the ability, not only should we do it whether we have the ability at this particular point in time, we should do it at any time. But in this particular case, we've got the ability in the 01-03 period on the best information that we've got available. We will have $11,456 billion coming in the 01-03 period. Even if we pass a budget this time with current services plus enhancements, that will run approximately in roll-up cost in the 01-03 period, $11,364 million. That leaves you $92 million left over. That $92 million should be spent first to fulfill our obligation of being fair. I do have some amendments, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to leave that the legislative revenue staff has helped me on, and specifically they're the ones that they have numbered 1, 3, and 4. And I would like those to be considered if you desire.
Do you want to address those or just?
I think I would leave that to the legislative
revenue staff. I had another question I wanted to ask you too before you left. As you know, earlier this year, we passed a bill that would have really, I think, called for some fairness with respect to timber taxation. One that just simply said that people who are now taxed, paying property tax, who happen to have some timber on their land, pay the property tax, and then upon harvest get the grand privilege of paying the harvest tax, unlike those who have forest land who, when they harvest, pay the harvest tax. And we saw the fundamental unfairness. We made a change in the Senate. The House agreed. The governor vetoed the bill. Just today, as you know, we had debate on a fairness issue, passed with great support, deals with expatriates. There's a fear that the governor will do as he did on the timber bill and veto this. So clearly, we know that fairness is not the hallmark of this administration. What do you think is the prospect of this bill?
Mr. Chair, I have serious concerns that this bill is going to be vetoed, and that does cause me a great deal of discomfort. In the short time that I've had an opportunity to serve, and with all of the issues that have come before us, as tough as those issues are, whether they're education or whether they're public safety or health and human services, I'll tell you what the biggest issue that I find in my community is people distrust government. And one of the reasons they distrust government is when government tries to make an argument, it can't afford to be fair. It can't afford to be fair to its citizens. It's not a message that builds trust. And the timber issue that we had, with the issue that was before us today, and the issue that you have before your committee today, it gets to that fundamental principle that government has to be fair. If it is not fair, if it says, I can't afford to be fair, I can't spend the money that it's going to take to be fair, then people will disconnect with government. They will lose trust in government. And we will not be able to solve all the issues that we have. I think everything that you described, including this bill, gets at that fundamental point. And it is frustrating for me that not everyone agrees with that, that some would measure their level of commitment to fairness by some type of dollar sign, and at some point in time say, I can't afford to be fair. That's wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Other questions? Thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I think the message should be we need to be fair and we can afford to be fair. Yes. That should be the principle of government.
Thank you. And that we can't afford not to be fair.
Yes.
Thank you both.
We can't afford not to be fair.
Appreciate your testimony. Lynn McNamara. Is it Maria Keltner? No, no. Those are just the description. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. Get my written testimony in a moment. We want to thank the President very much for his comments about and his concern about cities and counties and the problems that have been created as a result of this process, retention taxation, and the remedies that have been associated with it. I'm speaking on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We favor an exemption of state and local government pension benefits from state income taxation, as is part of the bill, for work performed before October 1991. We think that this exemption will help cities a great deal because the cost of the remedies that have been put in place for those for taxation of those benefits has come to a cost to cities of $108 million. Over the next 30 years to pay those the remedy for up to $33.49. We receive no income tax revenue as the state does to help fund the cost, and so this bill would help us going forward in dealing with those costs. It will also return the tax status of state and local government pension benefits to what they were before this process of taxation and remedies came into place, which was the case for more than 40 years before the 1991 change. It appears that the DAS-1 amendments deal with our concern about how we might structure this to make sure that the remedies are dealt with sufficiently to clarify that both the Senate Bill 656 remedy and the House Bill 3349 remedies are handled, and we think that this will minimize any lost income tax revenue to the state. We have not taken a position on state taxation of private pension benefits. We don't want to tell the state how to spend its money, particularly as we don't want the state to tell cities how they should budget their money, so we have not taken a position on that. In my written testimony, there's a fair amount of detail about the history, which you're probably more familiar with than I. But on the third page is a chart that shows the present benefit structure for work performed before 1991 and work performed after 1991, and how we would see it on the right-hand part of that chart after the DAS-1 amendments were put into place, so that the work performed before 1991 would not be taxable. There would be no benefit from the remedies from Senate Bill 656 and House Bill 3349. And then going forward, it's structured in the way that it was intended, that the benefits would be taxable. A certain part of the remedy remains in place, and the House Bill 3349 remedy goes away. We think that this is a good approach. We hope that you will carefully consider it, and we think that it will really help the cost issues for cities going forward if we are able to stop those remedies and bring things back to the way they were and, as the President said, as they were intended to be. Thanks for having help answering.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you. Are you?
Good afternoon, Chair Miller and members of the committee. My name is Maria Keltner. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. The history, I think, has been fairly well presented, or very well presented. I have attached to my testimony, one of the pages is a brief outline of the court cases and the Oregon law changes. It's a brief chronology that some people have requested. AOC, the Association of Oregon County, supports legislation which restores the state and local pension exemption for work performed prior to October 91 and simultaneously ends the remedies of increased benefits for that same work. This is the League of Cities supports that legislation. The impact on counties has been substantial also in terms of funding that increased benefit. The figures that I computed based on the PERS actuaries estimates of the increased costs for counties as of the 97 valuation, so that would be January 1 of 98, the PERS participating counties owed PERS over $94.8 million present value at that point in time to pay for the House Bill 3349 tax benefit, the figure that was calculated. As for the 99-2002 biennium, using the 30-year amortization of that bill and starting the first payment on July 1 of 99, the counties would be charged over $12.9 million for the 3349 tax remedy. And increasing the county payroll with the assumption the actuary used of 4% a year and using the rate the actuary computed over that 30-year amortization period, we figured it would be over $325 million that counties would pay for the increased benefit of 3349. That doesn't include lost earnings because they didn't have the money in their account to accumulate earnings at the rate that PERS is generating earnings, assuming that those earnings are higher than 8%, which they have been. So the bill could be substantially higher in terms of the cost for the benefits plus the lost earnings. But these are the best figures we have at this point in time. The counties appreciate your considering the issues, considering the impact on the budget and the service levels at the county for county citizens, and ask for your help.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
George Berry.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'll keep my remarks very brief. I think Senator Yee and Senator Adams explained on behalf of local government, as well as the two speakers you just heard from, our concern about the burden that 3349 put on us as local employers. We would appreciate your viewing this matter from the equity and fairness issue and supporting this bill. And no further comment at this time.
Question. Thank you for coming. Jack Stollis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Stollis and I reside at 2410 Fisherville Northeast. I've been involved in this problem since 1989, and the organization I represent is the one that sued the state for tax and pension. The problem that I had with Senate Bill 7 related to the taking away of COLAs has been dealt with in amendments, which was my main concern. As far as the rest of the bill goes, I feel, well, let me give you my background. I spent 28 years in the AG's office, so I'm familiar with all this stuff. One of my clients was purged when I was still working. I think the legislature was grossly unfair when they made local governments and school districts pay for 3349. They did not create the problem. The legislature did. We told the legislature in 91 they couldn't tax our pensions. They didn't listen. We went to Supreme Court three times and got it settled. But the last time the Supreme Court upheld the legislature making local governments and school districts and state agencies pay for 3349. Considering the fiscal impact of this bill, you should consider how much less state agencies will have to contribute to PERS if this bill passes. I say it would probably be $100 million. The total package base amount of 3349 was $1.3 billion. You add in the interest over 30 years, and you're talking over $2 billion that local governments and state agencies are going to have to pay to take care of this problem. And I think this is by far the simplest and cheapest solution to the problem by doing it this way. However, I would request that you look at your whole card as regards Senate Bill 656, because I don't think you can repeal it. I think it became a contract right when passed, because if you look at 3349, they specifically say no contract rights are created under this bill, because they were aware of the fact that they had not put that language in Senate Bill 656. So there are some problems involved, but monetarily over the long run, I think this would be far less impact on state agencies and local governments, because some of these local governments are really getting hit heavy, and they're going to have to be paying for this over the next 30 years. Plus the hits they're taking with money match, between the two, some of them are getting to the point where they're going to be pulling out of purse because they can't afford it. And so these are all things I think you need to look into very carefully. And I guess that's about all I've got to say. I know this subject forward and backwards, and I'm secretary treasurer of the organization that I represent, and I run it out of my front room. We've got 8,000 members. And we pretty well keep up on what's going on. But this solution would have been real great if it had come up in 1991 instead of today. But it's the legislature that's got itself in the hole, and it's the legislature that's going to have to dig itself out, and I think that you're heading in the right direction to do it.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Thank you again. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 7? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 7. Gauge the feelings of the members. And, in fact, Mr. Yates, do you want to go through some of these amendments that are before us? If you could.
How about a quick run through the bill and then
all right.
So I'll be amendments. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
Page one of the bill, you're starting essentially with Chapter 316, which is personal income tax, Section 680.
I misspoke. We're still in a public hearing.
That's all we got for today.
Yeah. According to our schedule, that's our limitation. So we'll go ahead and continue to learn about the virtues.
I, as a member of the public.
Thank you.
So the section that you're working with right there to begin with are deals with income that is excluded from personal income tax. So you got a lot of stuff there that isn't changed. And what you're doing on page 2 is inserting at line 12 a new section G, which excludes private pensions that is attributable to private employment occurring before October 1, 1991. Now, recall that the October 1 date comes out of the Oregon Supreme Court ruling insofar as what was a contractual obligation as far as HERS was concerned. So that benefits accrued or accruing up to that date, which was September 29, 1991, the state had a contractual obligation or a contract to not tax those benefits. So we're dealing here with the same income for private individuals, and the way that you're calculating that is in the bottom part of that sentence where it says, you know, nobody's going to know this, so let's estimate it by just taking the number of months that you were employed prior to that date and dividing that by the total number of months during which you were contributing to your retirement plan. So if you worked 10 years before 1991 and 10 years after, you got a total work history of 20 years. 10 years before, 50% of your retirement income is excluded. So then we're defining some things in that section. You're allowing the surprise in subsection C or paragraph C, I guess it is line 23, the subtraction is allowed for private retirees only if they're over age 55. One of the amendments you'll see will add another section there which says that there's a limit that each individual may exclude up to 50,000, but not more than 50,000 in return. Again, that applies only to private individuals. You get pension income defined. It's a little bit different in the way it's defined for public and private. The target area should potentially reach the same type of pension income. So you don't have a stock option plan or something like that in the private sector. You have the types of private retirement plans which are similar to public retirement. Then on line 33, a new section H, which deals with state and local pension income. And again, this makes a change to, again, exclude the income, which the Supreme Court said there was a contractual right to the exemption. And then later we'll see that you also stop on the same income paying the benefit. Again, definitions, credible service, things that are you need to establish that way in which the allocation is made. Then on the next page in line 4, subsection I, you have the same treatment for federal pension. And again, this is exactly consistent with the decision which came out in January of the tax court in terms of the way in which federal pensions may be taxed. We obviously have the power to go ahead and completely exclude them, but this follows the procedures established in the court, and that's exactly the same as it is for state retirees and as it is for private retirees. The rest of that section then deals with other problems in the personal income tax. You see on line 3, page 4, the effective date. Page 4, line 4. Is January 1 of 1999. in an amendment, which we'll see in a few minutes, to use sort of bifurcate this section so that you address the private separately, although you address them in exactly the same way, you address them separately so you have two different effective dates. It would be January 1 applying to the changes for state and federal, and the January 1 of 2002 being the effective date for private. On page 7, line 12, section 6, subsection 6 has to do with, there's no change in the existing bill, has to do with benefits which were increased in 1991 in Senate Bill 656. These were based on years of service and varied from 0 to 4% depending on years of service. And whether you were, they were somewhat different for police and firefighters. That in this version is taken out in the dash 3 amendment, so that those benefits are repealed in the dash 3 amendment. On line 38, then, in the repealed subsection 7, you have the removal of the benefit increases under House Bill 3349. You also have the bill, if you look at the front page, repealing two sections, 238.375 and 238.380. Those are sections that directly relate to those House Bill 3349 benefits and the way in which you calculate them, wherein you actually use the tax rate to determine what the amount of the benefit increase is. Most of the rest here is section changes and reference numbers. The new language at the bottom of page 9 has to do with this, the fact that a membership in the organization is used for the purpose of determining whether you're entitled to certain benefits. And that was defined in one of the repeal sections. I picked it up out of that repeal section and put it in, added it to the law here. The dash one amendment. Let's see. I should have mentioned in the original bill, section 7, which is added on page 10. This is the procedure whereby PERS pays the COLAs. Okay, there's a cost of living allowance, which is an annual allowance. And the way in which that is computed is sort of the last computation that's made. So under the current law, PERS will increase your benefits as they're contributed under the law by the combination of the Senate Bill 656 benefits and the House Bill 3349. And then on top of that, add the COLAs. Now what this says is you've got to go back and recalculate those COLAs without those benefit increases. And the language was kind of unclear and people questioned exactly what was happening. And so one of the things, the Dash 1 Amendment 2, is to clarify that by saying that it's adding in there on the portion of a member's retirement allowance attributable to the increased retirement allowance is payable under 238.365 and 238.380, which are the House Bill 3349 increases. So it makes it clear that you're not just going to go back and eliminate all of the COLAs. The Dash 2 amendment, I mentioned earlier at one point that there was a limit of 50,000 in a amendment, and it's the dash two amendments that say a private retiree may take a contraction for up to, but not exceeding $50,000. There's no such limit on the public. The dash three amendments then essentially combine those two, dash one and dash two amendments together. Separate again to make the effective date January 1, 1999 for the change in state and local retirement that occurs, and to make the later effective date for the private retirees as 2002.
So with threes, we don't need the ones and twos?
That's correct.
Wild. Thank you. What is it on page 7? Where do we deal with that? The deletion of lines 12 to 37. Where do we deal with that in the dash 3?
Are you talking about amendments?
The dash 1 amendments, first issue date, dealing with page 7, printed bill delete lines 12 to 37. And I'm just in looking through the dash threes, I don't see that we've dealt with that in the dash three. So I'm curious.
Answer that more quickly than I can.
Good handoff. Next, do you want to where that is, or if it was
Chair Miller, members, good afternoon, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The dash threes do not combine the dash twos and dash ones. The dash threes, the content that's in the dash ones is not included in the dash threes. The dash two is in there, actually the dash threes do the same thing as the dash twos, except that they put that the private pension in with a $50,000 limit, effective tax years January 1, 2002 and later. The dash twos are put the $50,000 limit in, but it's tax years 1999 and later.
So, thank you. Replace the dash twos with, if we wanted all these, we'd have to have the dash ones if you wanted to change.
The two versions, the dash two and the dash three, are slightly different on the implementation date of the $50,000. The dash one needs to be passed all by itself if we agree.
Chair Miller, that's correct.
What I tried to say.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I understood what you were saying then.
Are there other questions of Johnson while we got him?
Not yet.
All right.
Not yet.
More to go.
Thank you.
Well, we're just getting through this and we're not having a work session with
you.
So.
No.
Oh. I haven't heard that one for a while.
Well, I'm over the hill.
The last set of amendments, again, the dash four amendments, most of what we've been looking at is in Chapter 238. There is a provision in Chapter 237 which requires local governmental police and fire pensions to give the same sorts of benefit increases to their retirees as the state gave under Senate Bill 656 and Chapter 33 ordinary. So this would repeal that. Kind of meaningless if you leave it in there, you pass the bill, there's no increase. But it would be clean in the sense to take that out.
All right. Thank you for the explanation. Are there any questions or further discussion?
All right.
Thank you for asking it. We did have a an impact, and at least in the Do the dash or do the amendments impact, you know, the cost that the Senate President alluded to? It's estimated to be around $93 million in the out year 2001-03.
You have two sets of sort of numbers here. One of which at the top says exempts first benefits earned before October 1991. They both say that. It says repeal first benefits in House Bill 3349. They both say that. And then the one you want also have repeal first benefits in Senate Bill 656, 1991. This is consistent with the Dash 3 amendment. And it is, I believe, what the Senate President was addressing. So what you have there on page one of this is the changes with respect to PERS retirees. In the first column there, you have the year that the change takes place, and then the tax loss. Now, this is money that the Department of Revenue would not receive in tax revenue through passing this bill and excluding some, excluding PERS benefits earned before 1991. Given that PERS does not pay those benefits, then they can presumably reduce assessments. And I've made certain assumptions here about how quickly they can do that, which may not be accurate. But basically, I've assumed that, you know, this assumes they can make that change by January 1, essentially, which is probably unlikely. So the assessments might not respond quite as quickly as I estimated here. But anyway, given that the assessments do respond, you catch up later for the same amount of money involved. But given that there's a change, what you should see is a reduction of $11 million there in agencies which are general fund funded. So that's a reduction in what you have to spend out of the general fund for salaries and benefits. Then the next column has to do with what schools would have to spend. And, you know, we can argue both sides of that, whether that's something you consider in your general fund or not. It seems like, certainly it's an arguable case that the amounts that state is going to appropriate for schools should be higher if they have to pay these costs, and on the other hand, it should be lower if they don't. To achieve some level of scholarship. Then OF represents other funds, so where you have people employed, say, by the Department of Transportation or other agencies which are not general fund funded, or even like human welfare, human resources where the funds are federal funds. Right, if they have to pay the additional assessments out of federal funds, it doesn't affect the state general fund. So I have not, the last column is not reduced by those amounts. And also then the column headed local represents the local governmental savings as a result of these. And the net impact then is the tax loss that the Department of Revenue experiences, less the reduction in general fund assessments, less the reduction in schools.
The hit on the budget really is.
Yeah. Page two then. You don't have any assessments to worry about when you change the taxation of private retirees. So all you have is a tax loss, and as you can see, this takes effect January 1 of 2002, and the Senate President referred to a biennial number for 2001-2003 of $93 million, and you can see the figure in the net state impact or the tax loss for that biennial. And then in the biennium when it's fully phased in, 2003-2005, plus you've got some growth in there, but you're up to $141 million in terms of the amount of revenue that the Department of Revenue will not receive.
Okay. I think maybe before the arrived, the Senate President had indicated that right now projections are that we have a surplus in the 4103 budget is around $93 million. So it just happened to work out. This could be financed as the currently projected surplus.
Easy come, easy go.
Question I had with respect to the what we're in the dash twos and now the dash threes on this $50,000 limit. Is that somewhere in here? I remember testimony about how you should be able to afford fairness. I'm not certain as to why someone who is $50,001 is not treated the same as somebody with $50,000.
Well, I just got I heard all that. You know, I like fairness. So is that in here anywhere, or is that maybe not?
It still came to the numbers.
That cut off?
Yes. Built into the estimates. In fact, it's in there incorrectly right now. I've got to figure out what to do with it.
Let me just say this. When you're working it in preparation for our work session, whatever you have to redo, fine, do it with that incorporated, the 50,000 limits, and then without. If you would, please.
Yes, it's easy. What's different, I sort of worked off the pattern of the kind of situation that was in the 95. That was in it. And there it was a 50,000 for return limit, as it is in this year, it's a 50,000 for purchase. So that's the adjustment I've got.
Yes, of course,
no data.
Which will help me anyway. You did a fan. Yes, Senator Beyer. To be real clear, the first chart, the one, just two column heads are two lines at the top is, what does that reflect?
Oh, the only benefits repealed there are 3349.
And that responds to which of the amendments? The original bill?
The original bill.
Just the original bill?
Yes.
And the other is the original bill with all amendments in.
The dash threes, the dash fours don't make any difference. Mm-hmm. And the dash ones, I assume that they make the bill say what it was really intended to say anyway. So, yes, all the amendments. I gave you a long page here. If you look at those first three, the first page is PERS, the second page is privates, and the last two are the combination. So it has on the top exemption PERS and private pension income. On the other ones, the important ones are the Senate president is addressing. The first page and the third page are identical. I don't have the combination. So I'll get another page to you, which combines the first two pages to give a net effect. Sorry about that.
All right, and just so that I'm familiar with the terminology also, this being April 15th, where we have the column that says tax loss,
yeah.
That is that's not to the individual taxpayer, that's the state.
That's the state.
He's what, general fund loss?
No, I just maybe I'd have a column that says tax gain for individual taxpayer, which would be an impressive number as well.
I see.
It certainly is.
Then you could have benefit loss, right?
Yeah.
If you want, I could write to cross that out and write that on.
Well, I'll probably remember it. Speaking of that,
Mr. Cherry, to be here.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7. And before I move on to our next bill, I just want to say that for those members who were there, Senator Beyer and myself had a very, I think, informative tour yesterday of the Department of Revenue. And I really appreciated the time Mr. Maneri was there, the director was there, and the only thing missing, I think, was Susan Browning, first time I knew her. She was sick. We were sick not having you there. But it was very good, and
a lot of very industrious, hardworking people over there who were taking money, really, who we, I think, probably underappreciate. And they're hard at it today, and they were hard at it, I'm sure they've been hard at it for a long time, but it was that and the map tour, the cartography.
Map.
I should have said cartography, you'd understand.
Yeah, I would have. Yeah, I'd have made it.
But it was great. We appreciate, Mr. Mayor, your time and your time of the department. All right. We will now get back to our schedule. I put in my folder, and we have the House Bill 2125. We have Liz Beth.
Yes.
Mr. Maneri. How good does it get?
Chairman Miller.
Let me open up the public hearing on House Bill 2125.
Yes. Chairman Miller and members of the committee. House Bill 2124. Did you start with 25?
I did go to 25.
Okay,
sorry if I'm out of order.
Okay, so with House Bill 2125, this is dealing with rail car transportation, private rail car companies, and the communication companies. And it's beginning by looking at the Department of Revenue and the particular transportation companies that they centrally assess. And for rail car companies that they centrally assess, they're going to send one bill to private rail car companies with personal property, which does not exceed $1 million in real market value. And Jim will go into some details about why they feel like this is helpful for that particular company. And the money then are collected by the department, and they're calculated by applying the assessed value on an average school and non-school tax rate, and then the funds are distributed to the county general and school funds. Then another issue is the Department of Revenue. This bill makes a change as far as the number of additional, they will get 2 additional weeks to schedule appeals hearings and issues orders. The examination review, correction, and equalization and apportionment of the rolls shall be completed now by the following August 1st of each year. And these tax changes will begin on July 1st of 1999. And then the other issue is on the delinquent interest charged on electric cooperative taxes, and it is reduced from 1% per month to 5-6% per month. So this is all of these have very minimal revenue impact, and we'll go into more detail on that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Maneri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I did provide a summary of the different topics. Sections 1 and 2 are simply a cleanup of language. The language in this, what this part of the statute does is the direction of which companies will be centrally assessed by the department as opposed to locally assessed by the counties. And this is your big interstate transportation and utility type companies. So all we've done is change some of the language to what's being used more today by PUC and others in terms of, as you can see, for instance, on line 14 of the first page, instead of listing the sleeping cars and refrigerator cars, they're just referred to as private rail car transportation today. So we were just putting in a little more modern language. It's all exactly the same program as we're running today. That's in sections 1 and 2. Sections 3 and 4 is a special provision that the legislature put in a while back for the efficiency of both the government and of the private sector, in this case rail cars. What you have is a company owns rail cars that are leased out, and those cars are, or used if it's a private company. Those rail cars come through Oregon. We determine the total value of their fleet, and then the Oregon share of that is a portion. So let's say that that's $1 million. And what we do in the normal course then would be we take $1 million value for their cars in Oregon, and then if they are running through, say, 12 counties,
we break that up and distribute the value to each county that the assessors put on the roll. The assessors then would take that piece and send out a separate tax statement to that company. So in the case of a small company like this, they could be getting 12 different bills for really quite small amounts, but they're inefficient for both the government and for the company in that case. So a while back, you said, well, okay, if their total value that you have in Oregon is under $300,000, why doesn't the department, when it figures out that value, go ahead and just bill the company, send them one bill, the company pays it, and then we distribute the money out to the counties. And it was such a small amount, that way it's much more efficient for each. Now, this particular program, the amount distributed, normally if the assessor puts it on the roll, the money is divided by into all the taxing districts, schools and cities, county special districts. In this case, it was such a small amount, and for efficiency purposes, you provided that basically it goes to the county and the school fund. It wasn't really worth for the small amount distributing out to all the districts. This is current law. What this bill proposes, we've run some numbers on it, and the bill proposes that that you increase the threshold from $300,000 to $1 million of value. The difference to the districts is insignificant in terms of the amount of distribution that goes out all the districts. That is any loss of money to them. But it still does provide the efficiencies. This would pick up another 20 companies in this range limit that then would only get one bill from the department for the year, and then we would distribute the dollars out to the counties. We did the run, and when you get over $1 million in value, it starts disturbing the amount of tax distribution among the districts and the counties, so we stopped at $1 million. Then sections 5 and 6, this involves the appeals process for these central assessed companies if they disagree with their value, and this is all of them, by the way, all the companies. If they disagree with their value, their first step of appeal is to the Department of Revenue for review. Now, this is a very short time period under statute. It's about 1 month for the director's office to receive the appeal, schedule hearings, and make decisions on these large companies. Typically, what we do in this time is we make a lot of adjustments with the companies. It's a time period when they provide more information, our staff looks at it, and they argue things, and we get a lot of adjustments made on that value before it goes on the roll. What we found, though, is the 1 month is a really tight period for making all the changes. So the proposal in this bill is to extend it about 2 weeks. And with that extra 2 weeks, we can get to all of the adjustments so that as correct the values as we can go to the roll, and it avoids companies even having to appeal to keep it open to make those corrections. This also, the assessors are okay on this too, because it's still time to get the values to the roll for that processing. So this adds about 2 weeks to the current time period. The last, and I discovered on my summary sheet that they another section was added. Section 8 basically is the implementation dates for sections 1 through 7. Section 9 is the fourth area. And that's an issue that came up last year on appeal with us from an electric co-op. Now, electric co-ops are able to pay an in lieu of tax, which is basically a gross revenue tax, and almost all of them choose that method. But there is one of them filed the return a day late and had to pay interest. The statute for the electric co-ops is tied into the general property tax statutes, which basically is if you're 1 day late, you're 30 days late for interest computation. And the interest computation in this case, instead of paying several hundred dollars, they paid several thousand dollars in interest. And so what this bill does basically, because this is a very different program, it changes the interest calculation to do like we do for income tax and other of our programs, which is on a daily basis. So
But in that case, a day late would be a day of interest due, not 30 days. And that covers the bill.
Are there questions? Thank you for your testimony. And speaking for myself, I appreciate when you've done this a few times, the way you've described these bills section by section. I'm sure the carriers appreciate it. I do. So thank you for that. If there are no questions, we thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2125? A witness. That's unusual.
You have a lot to say. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Candy Flickman. I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And we're here basically just to say thank you to the department for including this section in the bill. We don't make a habit of paying our taxes late, but if that should occur, we do appreciate the consideration that the department is willing to extend to us. So just here in support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2125? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2125. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2125.
Thank you.
Senator Wild.
I would move HB 2125 to the floor if they do pass recommendation.
Senator Wild moves House Bill 2125 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hartung.
Aye.
Senator
Breyer.
Aye.
Senator Carr.
Aye.
Senator Vice Chair
Wild. Aye. Senator Nelson. Vote aye. House Bill 2125 is passed to the floor. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2125. Senator Wild, thank you very much. All right, we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2124. I see that Mr. Maneri is back.
Whoa, thanks. How about that?
Either way. Elizabeth, do you want to do another lead-in?
Okay. The 2124, this measure is extending the personal property tax penalty to individuals who fail to file personal property tax return at all. This is just an error that was made in the statute of not extending that penalty to people who don't file personal property tax at all. This measure also adds a clause that once a taxpayer files an application and can show a good and sufficient cause to finally make, County Board of Property Tax Appeals can waive the penalty. And if the penalty is waived, it shall be entered on the roll as an error correction. And this becomes effective on July 1st, 1999. And then another issue in the bill is dealing with the deadline for which the certified ratio study and sales data to be collected each year. And currently there's a deadline of March 1st, and Department of Revenue would like to have that deadline removed and then just put it in their rules so they can specify in more detail the time limits for these studies.
All right. We thank you. Mr. Maneri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Maneri. Again, there's a summary for this bill. The first two topics are related. It has to do with penalties on personal property tax returns. You put these penalties, the legislature put these penalties into the law last session. They somewhat paralleled the income tax penalties for late filing of returns. But what was not clear in there, we I think what you intended for someone who failed to file a return, that you would also apply the penalties. The statute only refers to filing late. What happens is if a return isn't filed, if they, for instance, filed it the year before, judges will often send out a notice to remind them that they needed to file. If it turns out that there's no filing at all, the assessors and the assessors are aware of it, they will, based on the best information they have, propose an assessment to the taxpayer, and then the taxpayer has a chance to react to it and amend it if they want. It's really trying to get the filing. If in the case where they haven't filed and the assessor is now going to propose it and they didn't know if there's a penalty that would go with it, that would also be included along with those actually that were filed late. So the language is intended just to pick up the failures to file as well as the late filing. The provision along with that, what we caught was that under the personal property piece, there was no language as to the County Board of Tax Appeals, which is the first level of appeal, to waive the penalty. You have that in the similar statute for other kinds of returns, real property and combined, but we think it was just omitted here. And that way, if a penalty was assessed and a taxpayer had good reason to do it, I mean, there was some good reason why they had failed to file or had filed late, they can go to the County Board of Equalization and request that it be waived under the circumstances. We wanted to clear that power is available for waiver. The third piece, which is in the last section, has to do just with a workload relationship between the department and the counties, and that is as the counties are out determining values for the upcoming year, they provide information to us to check. Which is basically looking at current sales of property and see how the current sales benchmark with the values that they're going to be putting on the roll. The date in the law right now is March 1st. Actually, with the implementation of Measure 50, there are a number of changes going on, and we're simply asking for the flexibility by rule to put the deadline. I mean, what we do is work with the counties to figure out what really works. Rather than being stuck with a statutory deadline, we'd like some flexibility to move it depending on workload. That covers the bill.
Questions? Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From this wording, my understanding would be that either they waive it 100%, I mean, they waive it entirely, or it's 100% penalty, right?
Senator Wild, I think you're correct.
Yeah, nothing in between.
So there's no discretion to waive, under this wording, that's correct, there's no discretion to waive part of the penalty.
Other questions? Mr. Mineri, did you happen to listen to the discussion, if there was any, in the House when they considered this bill?
Yes, I was.
I just noticed that it wasn't unanimous support for this idea. Maybe it's captured in Senator Wild's concern. Do you know of any other concerns expressed in the debate?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There was a considerable debate over several hearings, actually over the law that was put in 97 as to the penalty structure. The penalty structure is, let me first tell you what the income tax structure is. It's, for the first period, it's 5%. Then there's a timeline that goes on. If you're beyond that, it jumps to 25%. And then after another timeline, it goes to 50, which is the maximum. There are special provisions for 100% for fraud or 3 years of consecutive non-filing, but it's basically 5, 25, 50. The 97 legislation put in 5, 25, and 100. And the debate was over whether 100 seemed too harsh, a penalty doubling the tax in the case of that sort of late filing. In the end, most of the members of the committee said, well, this has only been in effect for 2 years now, or 1 year of filings, and we would rather have more information when from the counties based on a little more experience before they wanted to disturb it. That was the debate that went on. It was over the actual current law structure.
And that was true both in the committee and on the House floor?
I don't recall on the House floor if that was raised.
Okay. All right, thank you. Are there other questions? All right. I thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else?
Back out.
You wish to testify in House Bill 2124. Not today. All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2124. And I think the chair will try to absorb the concerns of the naysaying 22 on the other side before we proceed on this bill. if they have continuing objections, but we'll see. So anyway, I'll close the public hearing. Is there anything further to come before this committee today? If not, we are adjourned.